Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
We are facing the reality that we need about $5.9 trillion to get on track by 2030.
The COP28 conference on climate change ends with calls to phase out fossil fuel.
They are afraid there's going to be rigging. But when we talked with Patricia, she said they have all system in place. And she said the main important thing is not only CENI which is responsible, it's the political parties themselves also, they're responsible.
DRC Electoral Commission promises credible elections.
We have called severally, you know, to the investigative organs in the country to make sure that there is no witch hunt, that there is a very transparent process in order to, you know, find out those involved.
And ECOWAS Commission says it will continue to engage with all stakeholders to maintain peace and stability in Sierra Leone. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Dubai, the COP28 conference on climate change has ended with calls to phase out fossil fuels. But some say the conclusion of the summit yielded few concrete results on how countries are expected to do that and to address the impact of climate change happening worldwide. In an exclusive interview, I spoke to Patricia Scotland, the Secretary General of the Commonwealth of Nations, about COP28 and what she says are lack of climate resilience opportunities and funds for countries already dealing with the effect of a rapidly heating world. Here's part one of the interview.
We have to celebrate the fact that within 12 months, to have got it from agreement to conceptualizing and having a fund is a success. And the $726 million that's been so far committed is a milestone. And that the UAE putting in that first $100 million was a landmark. However, having said all of that, we know it is just a drop in the ocean for what we need. We are facing the reality that we need about $5.9 trillion to get on track by 2030. And if you look at how much we need for the developing countries to get to net zero, we need about $4 trillion a year between now and 2050. We also know that the countries who are suffering the most did the least to create it. So 80% of the greenhouse gases was caused by G20 countries, no, less than 5% by those developing countries, particularly the small island developing states in the global south. That is our reality. And if we want justice, climate justice, we're going to have to do better and do more.
Madam Secretary General, talk to me about the operationalization of the loss and damage fund. What are your thoughts about how this is going to be done after it's been agreed upon at the COP28?
Well, I think it has to have a fast, effective, efficient system. We cannot put in a system which is so complex, so difficult, so burdensome that the countries who are most in need of it are least likely to be able to access it. And you know that we have done what I believe is a phenomenal job in improving the speed with which we can make applications if we choose. Here at COP, we've just issued an e-learning toolkit, which anyone can use in any country, although it was made by us, for helping climate finance advisors to make applications fast. So I think that the fund is going to have to take advantage of what we know about how to make application process simpler to enable our member states to do it. Wouldn't it be fantastic if, having replenished the fund, number one, everybody who pledged actually paid? And wouldn't it be a marvellous thing if by the time we came to the next COP, all the $726 million had actually been distributed?
Madam Secretary General, let me get your thoughts or the Secretariat's thought on releasing or realizing the promised $100 billion in annual climate financing for developing countries from polluting economies.
Well, that was a promise, Peter, you know, that was made in 2009. Everyone has been thirsting for that money and that opportunity. We still haven't got the 100 billion. But we have to get there, and we have to get there quickly. And what I'm hoping is that with that 100 billion, and in relation to the pledges that are being made on loss and damage and the pledges that hopefully will be made on adaptation and the other elements, that people won't just pledge. I'm praying that they will pay. And it won't be old, recycled money. It would be new, real money, which can be put into the hands of people who need it. But look at what we did just this year. For five countries in SADC, our climate finance advisor was able to make an application on behalf of those five countries for water, looking at the Zambezi River. And we managed in less than a year to get $63 million to help those five SADC members in order to deliver on water. What if we could do that all across the Commonwealth? We would really then be cooking with solar.
Patricia Scotland is the Secretary General of the Commonwealth of Nations. She spoke with me from Dubai, United Arab Emirates. Join us on Sunday for the conclusion of this conversation. The spokesperson for the DRC Electoral Commission, or CNE, says Wednesday's general election will proceed as planned. This, despite reports that the election may be postponed. Patricia Mulela tells VOA that the electoral body has implemented measures to prevent rigging as part of the effort to ensure the polls are credible. Her remarks come as the candidates intensify their campaign ahead of the polls. For the latest development, I reached my colleague Abdul Shakur Aboud, who is on a special assignment in the DRC to cover the elections.
With Patricia Mulela, she had a firm confirmation that elections are going to be held on December 20th and that they are totally ready. They have been distributing all the voting materials to the different provinces and the different districts. So she is confident, and she said that she heard the rumors that they want the elections to be postponed, but at her level, they are not talking of any postponement. They believe they are ready for the elections. So that's the main thing, I think, which contradicts what people are hearing. They confirm that they're ready for the elections on the 20th.
I understand campaigns are underway in the capital, Kinshasa, where you are. You have also been able to speak with some of the officials of the opposition candidates. Talk to me about what's going on today.
Well, today, Fayulu, one of the main candidate of the opposition from the Alliance of Lamuka, who was defeated by Tshisekedi 2018, is right now, as we are talking, having a big campaign. He came in walking, and Tshisekedi is having his last meeting here also on Monday, we understand, and another or other number of politicians. So one must understand that it's a huge process, because it's not only the presidential election, it's the general election where they're electing 500 members for the national parliament, and they're electing members of the different provinces, and for the first time, councillors. And what is making it a big campaign is that 500 seats of the parliament is being contested by 20,000 people. So you have 20,000 people campaigning all around the nation. We talked with the Secretary General of the opposition from Fayulu, and he underlined the fact that they believe the CENI, the Electoral Commission, is not ready, but they are ready. and they're going to go for the election. And he warned that if the elections, there is any type of fraud. So they said this time they're going to have a mass popular uprising. But he didn't say if it was going to be violent. He said it's going to be peaceful.
Moise Katumbi, Martin Fayulu, and Dr. Mukwege are expressing concern about the lack of transparency or that there could be potential rigging. What are you hearing on the ground?
Yes, that's true. That's what they are complaining. They are afraid there's going to be rigging. But when we talked with Patricia, she said they have all system in place. And she said the main important thing, it's not only CENI which is responsible, it's the political parties themselves also, they're responsible. There was a case that their ballots, which were stolen 2 days ago by the opposition. She says that it's mixed and DRC is so complicated. Even the politicians are included in the fraud and everything. But they have a system which is electronic. They're sure they can avoid the rigging. So the opposition are worried that they're feeling the CENI is not prepared for this election. But what is happening here, there is an independent observer group by Congolese. There are about 1,800 of them. They've been spread all over the country. And the Catholic Church also is following. So the political parties also have members and witnesses at every polling station. They're making sure that the rigging won't take place.
My colleague Abdul Shakur Aboud is on a special assignment to cover the DRC elections. He spoke with me from the Congolese capital, Kinshasa.
Experts say cultural expectations and individual aspiration are often the source of tension and frustration between parents and children in the diaspora, particularly with girls. This week on Our Voices, we'll hear young African women talk about their quest to educational and career achievements in the West while trying to fulfill their parents' wish to preserve family heritage, culture, and religion. Join the conversation Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on the Voice of America.
Still in the DRC, an independent analyst is calling for a serious commitment from political leaders for the economic empowerment of citizens living in the rural areas. This, Al Kitenge says, will significantly help in easing security challenges facing the country. He traced those concerns in parts of the country to a lack of economic opportunity for the youth, which he says makes them vulnerable to recruitment by rebel groups. His remarks come as presidential candidates intensify their campaigns ahead of the coming elections on Wednesday. For more about his call, I reached Al Kitenge in the Congolese capital, Kinshasa.
You need to know that this country is potentially very rich, but in reality, it's very poor. Then the truth is, I don't believe in what people say during the propaganda. What I believe is their commitments to change the lives of the people. And what I would say as a strategist is, there is no way we can have a serious impact if we do not have a very strategic approach to rural economy. Rural economy in this country is more than 75% of the people touched by rural activities in very deep poverty. We need to have a very strong commitment to spend money into the rural areas. And what I'm saying is that if we need to start changing things, we cannot go slowly. We need to start a very important and huge impact initiatives towards those who are the less privileged, which is rural area people.
Have these presidential candidates really come out with some of these policies that you think will jumpstart or pump in economic measures to uplift the people in the rural areas that you talk about?
The only person who's talking about something tangible is the current president. He's talking about his 145 territories project. Then, when it comes to that 145 territories project, which is actually a fully rural area strategy, we need to commit to put money on a 10-year plan into this place, which is actually behind what he's doing now. He has to commit to put more money in the rural area. And this must be together with a vision of ecosystem being protected and make sure that charcoal is not the dictatorship of the economy of rural areas as it is now.
But critics say he had his first term. People did not see that. So what makes you think that he could convince the people that in his second term, this is what he plans to do by improving their living conditions?
No, the reality is that people talking about something they don't know, because he has started for the last 2 years and a half this 145 territories plan. 1.6 billion has been allocated to 145 territories. This is the very first time during the 60 years of independence where we spent money in the rural area. Then what I'm saying is that the first step was infrastructures, government presence and whatever. Now we need to keep sending money in these territories for the economy. And it's only by changing the economy of rural areas that we can change the destiny of this country.
But how are the people responding to some of these economic promises these political leaders or presidential candidates have been talking about?
In this country, politics comes behind economics. People don't understand economics, they understand politics. So all the game during the campaign is not an economic game, it's all about politics. But what I'm saying, behind politics, there is public management. It's very important that citizen, educated people start raising the voice to claim the importance of creating a serious economy in this country.
Doesn't it involve educating the masses in order for them to demand improved living conditions? Because as you said, the instability or security concerns in the eastern part of the country is due to poverty.
You're totally right. And the fact is that to influence the people, you need first of all to connect with them. For the last 63 years, it's only the last 2 years that the government is now trying to touch base with these rural areas. These are places where there was not even an office for the government. There was nothing. To educate the people, you need to get in touch with them. And today, and that's where we need to go, we need to understand that if we don't give them public services, these people are going to become enemies of the country.
Are you hopeful that these presidential candidates will do as they say when they come to power in terms of improving the living conditions, especially of rural people?
The demand of citizens must be the driver. I don't believe in one person doing everything. We need to become responsible citizens, being to able to help our weakest part of the country, which is uneducated people, rural people, and give them the opportunity to raise their voice. These are our brothers and sisters. We cannot just leave them in the condition they have been in the last 60 years.
Al Kitenge is a political analyst. He spoke with me from the Congolese capital, Kinshasa. In Mozambique, the Media Institute of Southern Africa, or MISA, a regional press freedom organization, plans to present a petition to the Attorney General demanding protection for journalists in the country. This after João Chamus, co-owner and editor of the independent weekly newspaper Ponto Poponto, was found dead near his home on the outskirts of the capital Maputo. MISA is calling on the authorities to launch an independent investigation into his murder and punish whoever is involved, adding that Chamus' death is one too many in Mozambique. Ernesto Inhanali is the executive director at MISA in Mozambique. He tells me that the government must act because it is responsible for the safety of all citizens in the country.
The authorities must investigate that case and bring at the light the truth. This is not the first case which a journalist is murdered in an situation which we don't understand what happened. So and our position is that we need to know what happened in that night where Jean Chamus were married at his house. We need an investigation, and also we need the authority to take action to responsibilize the people who are in charge of that situation.
João Chamus, I understand, participated in the fight for press freedom and freedom of expression. Some people are saying that the government or the authorities should protect journalists, since this is not the first time it's happening. What do you say to that?
Yes, I know. The big challenge here is that people are making links. Those links are fair in the context which people make those links. That's why we are saying that the authorities to avoid unfair links connected to the case. They need to investigate and communicate this finding in a credible manner, which will help us to clarify what exactly is happening. So if the police is conducting an investigation on the matter and the way they release the result is not credible, so what we will think as a public opinion, you know? And also the murder of Shamus happened in a context where is normal authority not protecting journalists. So we don't know exactly what happened. But what we know is that Shamus were murdered, and the state is the one who is responsible to investigate and bring the result of the investigation to the public using correct channel of communication.
Will MISA engage the authorities to address concerns about security or protection for journalists in Mozambique?
That is our job, but there's no result. That's why today we are organizing a public act, which we will consist on a petition and a general atonement. So we will be working today on Monday 10, and we invite all friends of freedom of expression to join us Monday. We will be departing for MISA, walking to the general atonement to deposit there our petition. This petition is to call for action to the authority to reinforce mechanism to protect the journal. So we need to do that to claim that all we are doing, all engagement we are doing, they don't result on correct mechanism to protect the journal.
Ernesto Nhanali is the executive director at MISA in Mozambique. He spoke with me from the capital, Maputo. In Zambia, a leading member of the Opposition Patriotic Front, or PF, in parliament says it is illegal for anybody to remove the elected leader of the minority and chief whip of the group. Stephen Kampiongo was recently removed as the chief whip of the opposition in parliament. He says the apparent confusion in the party is intended to destabilize the PF ahead of the next general election. He also says weakening opposition groups in Zambia to prevent them from acting as a check on the government will erode the democratic gains made by the Southern African country. The Speaker of Parliament suspended Kampiongo and the minority leader for more than 30 days. This while other members were suspended for 1 month after being accused of unruly behavior in the legislature. They have also been expelled from the PF party by a faction led by Miles Sampa. For reaction to the latest development in the main opposition party, I reached Stephen Kampiongo.
In short, I can just say that we have had this sponsored, organized confusion in the party. All they are doing is trying to consolidate themselves, but they are forgetting that the real problem they have are the starving stomach of the citizens. Because right now, for people to just put the decent meal on the table is a challenge, it's a tall order. And so, in a nutshell, Mao Sampa started misconducting himself and the party punished him by expelling him.
Are you saying the maneuvers in parliament to remove Mundebele as the leader of the opposition in parliament, elected leader of the opposition in parliament, and your position as the chief whip is illegal according to the Zambian constitution?
Yes, indeed. It is illegal. I wouldn't just go so much into the details because now these matters are subject to the courts of law. We are using the civilized way of trying to address these matters, despite the anguish that these actions have caused to our members. So we have opted to pursue the legal route, and we are very hopeful that the judiciary would be above board.
A lot of Zambians that I have spoken with are of the opinion that the main opposition party has itself to blame if its members are not committed enough and will be willing to cause confusion within the party. Then the party has itself to blame for not getting people that they can trust. The party itself is to blame rather than blaming what some people are saying and on seeing hand trying to cause confusion within the party.
I hear you, and I hear those lamentations coming from the people. But truth be told, that if there was no invisible hand coming from the state, which we have verified, which we have approved, and the funding that this man is getting. Even now, as I speak to you, he can't talk freely. He's not a free person with, together with a few collaborators he's working with, be it in Parliament or elsewhere. He's not a free person. So if he was really a person that is chosen by the membership of the party, why would he be so fearful that he has to move with the state police? We have never seen the kind of support we are seeing being given to these colleagues of ours who are causing confusion in PF by the state. It's very clear for everyone to see. And if that wasn't the case, the party mechanisms that are put in place to deal with indiscipline through the disciplinary committee would have dealt with these matters and they would have been closed.
We understand that you just returned to Parliament following over 30 days of suspension. Some people are saying that you were suspended due to what people say unparliamentary or unruly behavior in Parliament, which they said sets a bad precedent for the people of Zambia to see a prominent leader, they said, behaving badly. How do you respond to that?
Peter, first the question should be, why would this eminent leader, who has been a legislator for more than 10 years, only become such a bad person to conduct himself in a disorderly manner or dishonorable manner? That could be the question. Some of the occurrences in Parliament, which are looking dictatorial, is what we're trying to fight. The particular event that culminated into the 30-day suspension, you must have seen a young member of Parliament, very vibrant, disciplined, Engineer Kangombe, was just trying to deliver a point. And we got our privileges as members of Parliament to speak within the confines of the law and within the confines of the rules. The honorable member was trying to drive a point, and he was ill-treated by the presiding officer. So we protested that kind of micromanagement of members and curtailing them from expressing themselves, sitting on their privileges. And that's what we were trying to drive. There was a ruling, there was a decision by the presiding officer that he could be hounded out of the house without following procedure. And we protested that because when the member has defied the orders of the speaker, they are given chance, and the speaker should treat members on mutual respect kind of arrangement. So we stood to be with the member.
Stephen Kampiongo is a leading member of the Opposition Patriotic Front, or PF. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. In Uganda, the General Secretary of the Opposition Party Justice Forum, or GEMA, is demanding an apology and retraction from the leader of the Opposition National Unity Platform, or NUP, parliamentarian Robert Kyagulanyi, popularly called Bobi Wine. This after the opposition leader accused fellow parliamentarians, including members of his own party, of working with the government to pass the anti-homosexuality bill. In a letter to Bobi Wine, Katerega Mohammed said the measure was initiated by parliamentarian Asuman Baselerua, the head of the opposition GEMA party. He expressed concern that Wine appears to be wants to please his benefactors abroad with his latest criticism of the anti-LGBTQ law, despite what he says is majority support the measure has across Uganda. For more reaction, I reach Katerega Mohammed.
Of course, we cannot take this accusation in good faith because Mr. Kyagulanyi has not produced any evidence to that effect. Two, this law united all people of Uganda. All members of parliament across parties voted for this law. And he had an opportunity to caucus with his members of parliament. He did not do it. And now, because he wants to get favors from Western world, that's why he went out and accused his members of parliament and members from opposition parties to have worked with President Museveni to ensure that this law passed.
But Mr. Katerega, Robert Kyagulanyi or Bobi Wine ordered, according to reports, that all the legislators from the NUP return the funds that were given to them, what he claimed to be bribes. Some people are saying this is worthy of applause and that others should follow suit. that they should not be bribed for doing their work, literally.
They are not bribed. There is no evidence to that effect. This law was brought or was initiated by a member of the opposition party, Mr. Asmani Basaliwa, and he presented to Parliament as a private member's bill. But because there is a lot of support from the population, that's why each and every member wanted to associate himself or herself with what was going on in Parliament at that time. But if I challenge Honorable Chagulani to produce evidence, we demand from him to retract the statement because he has no basis. Just one tarnishing the name of our good MPs who have diligently done their work.
This is not the first time a member of parliament from the opposition is claiming that they have been bribed. The first time, age limit was removed. The other was when term limits were removed from the constitution that allowed for people to run irrespective of their age. So people are saying in Uganda that his accusation or what he's saying, it might not be wrong after all, because there has been precedence.
No, as far as the age limit bill was concerned, I can agree with Honorable Chagulani that there was some kind of bribery, because the bill was only supported by members of the NRM, and that it is on record that it is only members of NRM who received bribes. Members from the opposition party were beaten, were harassed. A number of them ended up in jail because they tried to cause commotion in the house.
After the call for him to retract or provide evidence of his accusations, what happens next?
For us, we shall continue advocating for what we believe in, and what we believe in is what Ugandans believe in.
Which is?
It is up to Honorable Chagulani to rethink his position, because in Uganda, we don't believe in homosexuality and don't support it, and we don't need money from the homosexual lobbyist. For him, he's just pursuing money, well knowing that what he's pushing is not supported by Ugandans.
But are you not also making an allegation without proof that he is pursuing money abroad?
If it is not money, then what is he pursuing? Because he knows what Ugandans believe in. If he doesn't want to impress the West, what is he trying to do? The Parliament of Uganda has 529 MPs. Only two members of parliament voted against the bill. And during the process of voting or before the voting, Honorable Chagulani did not find the time to focus, to direct, to guide his MPs. Why come out at the same?
Katerega Mohammed is the General Secretary of the Opposition Party Justice Forum, or JIMA. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. In Chad, the opposition Transformers Party is calling on the authorities to respect the wishes of the people in the referendum on a new constitution on Sunday. Official figures show about 8 million citizens are eligible to vote on whether the country adopts a new constitution. The military junta and some political parties want citizens to vote yes to adopt the new document, but critics say the referendum appears to be a move to enable General Mahamat Debi, the leader of the transitional military government and son of deceased former long-time President Idris Deby, to consolidate power. Some political parties are calling for a boycott of the vote. They are expressing concern about what they say is the lack of transparency and accountability, an accusation that government supporters deny. For more reaction from the Transformers Party, I reached Ndolembai Njesada Sade. He is the vice president in charge of the diaspora in bilateral relationships of the group.
We as a Transformer have presented the choices to the people of Chad to decide. In fact, even within our team, there are two camps. Those who wanted to vote for the constitution that is proposed right now as a unitary state, and those who don't want to vote for it because they want to aspire for a federal state. However, the way things are being presented right now, there is only one constitution that's presented, which is based on a unitary state. So voting yes, meaning we vote for this constitution. Voting no, meaning we don't vote for this constitution, which means we have to extend the transition in order to come up with federal constitution in order to submit it again for another referendum. So that will extend, in a sense, the transition phase. But if people vote yes for the current constitution, though it's not the best, it will at least put an end to this transition by October 2024, because the presidential election has to be held by then and results will be given. So the new government would be able to now take over and be able to reorganize or rework the constitution based on what the people of Chad want.
So what is the expectation of the Transformers Party, particularly with this referendum? What do you want to see?
We would like to see at least something better than the chart that is registering the country as of now. Even though the current constitution that was presented is not one of the best ones, at least it's based on the one of 1996, which is the only one that went through the referendum process. So for us, in order to co-manage the remaining time of the transition, we would like to have the country be registered under a constitution, though not the perfect one. Ideally, voting a yes will give us a timeline on when we will be having the election and move forward with the country to a democratic country.
Do you think the Transformers Party has a groundswell of support?
I don't think my word will be sufficient because we are doing a caravan throughout the country. And as you can see, everywhere we go, thousands, if not millions of people are coming out to welcome us. As we speak, we're in the Mayo-Kridi East region and thousands of people are showing up. And at the same time, the other parties are doing their campaign, but comparing the numbers of people who are welcoming us to theirs, many people are saying that we don't even need a referendum. We should go straight to the election because there is no doubt that the Transformers will win the presidential election because we have the majority with us.
Some people have been expressing concern about the credibility of this referendum. What is your take?
Regardless of its credibility or not, what's important for the people of Chad is to have a constitution. That is going to be much better than the chart of the military council right now. So it might be rigged for a yes or for a no. At the end of the day, what counts for the people of Chad is to have a constitution. Make sure that the will of the people is respected here.
People believe that the status quo looks certain to remain. If that happens, for the status quo to remain, what would be the Transformers' position?
Our objective is not focused on the referendum. We are focused on the election because we know we will win. And once we win the election, we will have the opportunity now to really work with the people of Chad to reshape things according to the desire of the majority, which is what is called democracy. Because many of the things that have been done the last year were done without our presence because we were in exile. But now that we're back in the country and in the field, impacting everything that's going on, though the referendum has been prepared before us, whatever the outcome it is, it will not make a big difference to us because we need a constitution in order to move on to the election. And once we will win the election, we will have the power with the people of Chad to restructure the constitution according to the desire of the people of Chad.
Ndolembai Njesada Sade is the vice president in charge of the diaspora and bilateral relationships of the Transformers Party. He spoke with me from New York.
This weekend's issues in the news. We'll speak with a mother whose 19-year-old daughter is still being held by Hamas as families of the hostages demand more efforts to get them out. Israel vows to continue fighting and a deep dive into what that means for civilians struggling to survive. Also, Ukraine moves a step closer to joining the EU but hits another pitfall in military aid. Listen this weekend on VOA's Issues in the News.
The Department for Political Affairs and Security for the ECOWAS Commission says the sub-regional body will continue to engage with all stakeholders in Sierra Leone in the effort to maintain peace and stability in the country. Abdel Fattah Moussa says it is determined to bolster democratic gains while engaging with military regimes to expedite their return to constitutional rule. His remarks come after regional leaders agreed to send a standby force to help stabilize the situation in Sierra Leone following the November 26 coup attempt. The authorities in Freetown have since launched an investigation to arrest those accused of playing a role in the attempt to overthrow the administration. For more on efforts to help stabilize the situation in Sierra Leone, I reach Abdel Fattah Moussa.
You know, the chair of the ECOWAS Authority dispatched its national security advisor with the ECOWAS Commission president to the country to survey the situation. It was during those discussions that ECOWAS looked at the possibility of deploying a stabilization support mission, you know, just to make sure that we don't have a repeat of what was happening, because that was about the second time in a few months. And given the history of Sierra Leone, we just felt that it was very important that we halted this slide into instability, you know, in the country. So it is in that context that the whole decision about trying to deploy a force to help stabilize the country was taken. So it's very significant, you know, number one, given the general environment in West Africa with sort of attacks at the state institutions, at the backsliding democratic processes.
The government in Sierra Leone is undertaking investigations to arrest those who were involved in the attempted coup. Is ECOWAS still engaging with the authorities in Sierra Leone to, you know, to assess the situation on the ground and to find the best foot forward?
We are. We are indeed. And we have called severally, you know, to the investigative organs in the country to make sure that there is no witch hunt, that there is a very transparent process in order to you know, find out those involved in the jailbreak and the disturbances, you know, in Sierra Leone with the government characterized, and we believe so, like an attempted takeover of government. We believe that there should be a very transparent process, you know, so that any eventual prosecution or anything like that is based on fact and not witch hunt. You know, so we are following very closely, and we are in constant touch with the authorities in Sierra Leone, not only the authorities, but also on the opposition, because as you are aware, the former president, Ernest Bai Koroma, has been invited, was invited for interrogation, and the Inspector General of Police saying that at this stage, he was considered a suspect.
A lot of people have expressed concern recently about the surge, or so to speak, the slide back of democratic gains in West African countries. Now, will ECOWAS use this as a stepping stone in the situation in Sierra Leone to also reach out with efforts to try to transition those military takeovers into constitutional rule? So,
yes, indeed, that is what we are doing. If you you followed the summit, the, you know, ECOWAS summit that took place on the 10th of December, decisions were taken, you know, to you know, talk to speed up the engagement with the four countries under military rule, whether you are talking about Burkina Faso, Guinea, Mali, and now Niger, to quickly get them back on the way to, you know, what is it, constitutional order, you know, in the country. Concrete decisions were taken, committees of heads of state created to engage them actively, you know, to make sure that we quickly restore constitutional order in all the four countries. That is number one. The summit also decided to undertake deep reflection on the democratic backsliding, to look at the interrelationships between electoral processes, democracy, development, and governance issues. Because despite the fact that the region is also being, you know, sort of devastated by terrorism, you know, and other asymmetric, you know, conflict environment, fake news, and all that misinformation, disinformation, the issue of governance is also central. So this is also something that we are going to undertake in order to go to the structural factors that are leading to sort of this backsliding in the democratic culture. This is a region where 3 years ago, all presidents were democratically elected, and within a period of 3 years, we've already had four coups and so many other attempted coups.
Abdel Fattah Moussa is Commissioner, Political Affairs, Peace and Security at ECOWAS. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Right now it's time for music from our collection.
Oh, by golly, have a holly jolly Christmas this year. in case you didn't hear. Oh, by golly, have a holly jolly Christmas this year. Tries to stop. Rocking around the Christmas tree, let the Christmas spirit ring. Later we'll have some pumpkin pie and we'll do some caroling. You will get a sentimental feeling when you hear. Bows of holly, rocking around the Christmas tree, have a happy holiday. Everyone dancing merrily in the new old-fashioned way.
That was music from our collection, and we hope you enjoyed it.
Jingle bell, jingle bell, jingle bell rock. Jingle bell swing and jingle bell ring.
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Nicole Peters and engineer Al Santos, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, one who has been bitten by a snake lives in fear of worms. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.